Diversity.
Years have caused confusion.
I'll crash his board.
Well, hello everyone, and welcome to Office Hours, where I'm here. We're a little bit early today, but it's probably for the best so that Pharaoh and myself don't get stream sniped by the school run, essentially. So we're doing it a bit early today. And I'm also joined, so welcome back, Pharaoh. Pharaoh returns with a V. And also making his Office Hours debut. Been a while, Marcus. How are you doing?
Oh, wonderful, thanks. Good to be here. Good to be back. Love the revamp, AA. And contrary to stereotype, I actually managed to be also early. So here we are.
Yes. Well, that's because it's not like 5 a.m. like it was when we
True.
Were doing
that. Indeed. That helps.
You know, we're in the brave era of daytime streaming now, so it's probably nighttime for you, right?
I literally just had dinner, so perfect.
Marcus wanted to jump on because as we're going to be talking about the government's war on farmers and Jeremy Clarkson on the show, you actually come from a farming background, right, Marcus? Your family owns a farm, or you run a farm.
Indeed. Yeah, multi-generational agricultural sort of enterprise, yeah.
So this is particularly personal for you, so I thought you'd be a very good person to get on. Mm. And also, you being in Australia, it shows the global, or the globalist, should I say, nature of this attack on the Kulaks, basically.
Essentially, and also the unique way this has actually happened in the Anglosphere, because the difficulties confronted by British farmers and, say, Australian farmers are not identical, but they're quite similar, and much of the top-down stuff has commonality.
Right. So now, just before we get going, I'm going to get up the sort by... How do I get the... Oh, yeah, there it is. From a super thanks. There we go. I'm just getting the super thanks up because it's been a while since I've done an Office Hour. So there's going to be quite a few questions today as well. All right. So earlier on today, I released a video about Jeremy Clarkson's. He's set to protest with the farmers next week. I think they're going to be driving their tractors to Parliament, which is going to be fun to watch. I think it's on the 19th. So today is the 12th. So exactly 1 week today, Clarkson is going to be leading this protest of farmers to Parliament. Honestly, I am hoping to see a repeat of what the Dutch did. Do you remember when they were slinging manure at the government and so on? And now, of course, the Dutch farmers are actually part of the Dutch government. You know, they were actually successful in that protest. But when I say war... This is actually, I mean, let me just play this clip and that'll be a good lead in for us to discuss this story, because when I made the Clarkson video, this had not happened. I was staggered when I saw this. I'll just play. We may even have to watch it twice because it's only a short clip.
That may or may not be right. I'm personally in favor of doing to, you know, farmers want to go on the streets. We can do to them what Margaret Thatcher did to the miners.
So just to be clear, Johnny, you would, what, beat them up?
No, close. I mean, this industry we could do without.
So, okay, all right, so this got weird. So you would do to farmers what Margaret Thatcher did to miners, which was, and you know, she
used industry.
Very heavy-handed police tactics, followed by what? Putting them out of business?
If people are so upset that they want to go on the streets and spray slurry on them, then... We don't need the small farmers.
Right. Okay, John, I'm not sure that's a position. You were, just to clarify, you were a former Labour special advisor, possibly emphasis on the word former there, but just to go on...
I mean, that is crazy. That is full-on Lenin, we must liquidate the kulaks sort of talk. I mean, what the fuck was that? Pharaoh, any reaction, sir?
Well... I think the whole thing's very interesting because there's multiple layers to it. I think the first thing I would say is, isn't that what Thatcher would do, though? You know, there was some interesting stuff going around earlier about energy prices. Like, why don't we just import all of our stuff? We've got one of the most expensive costs in the globe. Why don't we just import energy? That's the thing to do. Couldn't you do the same logic with this kind of stuff as well? You know, why don't you just import all your food? Why don't you import all of your coal? I think it comes from the same place, some kind of materialist, utilitarian, free market view of the world. It's going to create huge problems in the long term. And, you know, this is a strategic resource. It's something that's vitally important. It's both a form of anchoring in traditionalism, but also, just vitally important. And we think we can outsource that. You know, it's madness to me.
I mean, here's the thing, though, and before I bring in Marcus, if you actually have a look at how much of the food that we eat comes from British farms, it's still more than 50%. I mean, as a proportion of the population, agriculture has shrunk. You know, once upon a time, 80% of the population were, you know, subsistence farmers, you know, back in the pre-industrial era. That shrunk. But if you pick up my very expensive book, The Defenders of Liberty, I actually crunched the stats in there, and despite only being like less than 1% of the population, they do actually produce more than 50% of the food. Okay. So this idea that you could just substitute that with imports is mental. I mean, it's just great. There are surely goods that you can't just rely on imports for. You know, it's kind of, what happens if you, if relations sour with that country, or what if something goes wrong with the supply chain, or what happens? You know, you're basically asking for disaster versus getting milk from up the road. I mean, this is what we're talking about. But Marcus, you are personally invested in this, obviously. How did you feel when you heard that Labour douchebag talking about, we don't even need small farmers?
I think you need to play that Jose Mourinho clip about, I prefer not to speak because if I speak, I'll be in trouble. But obviously, seriously speaking, almost rage-inducing. Like, it makes my blood boil to see that sentiment, prevail in politics. And the thing is, it's one of those things that sort of is a very, very clear example of that sort of urbanite mentality, and not just an urbanite mentality, but also of that very sort of Malthusian anti-human sort of vein that runs through left's thought of all strands. Mm-hmm. And the way, in a very glib way, he basically said, we'll do to miners what we did to farmers. I mean, the thing is, and this is, I kind of agree with you, AA, when you posited the point about how Thatcher is to be thanked for destroying the last vestiges of the old way of living in England, in the United Kingdom, which I think is true. Yeah. And I agree with that. But the thing is like, even though miners are, you might say, very necessary and economically valuable, and the idea of a mining sector is a great asset to a country, providing they have those raw materials, they're not, I wouldn't call it essential, or certainly not as essential as what food is. I mean, food is sustenance, food is survival. And also, there's a particular thing about farming whereby it is, I suppose, like mining was once upon a time, but in terms of managing land, you know, turning the soil, you know, engaging in animal husbandry and breeding, and just the general management of farm operations and land care and what have you, that is a very, very difficult thing to pass on from generation to generation. And there is so much accumulated knowledge there that just can't be, you know, it's not like you can sort of, you know, pop out a floppy disk and install into another computer or something. I mean, that is extremely valuable knowledge that can be lost in a very short space of time. And I mean, you mentioned about the demographic difference between the number of farmers there are in the economy and how much food they produce. It's completely lopsided to what that was, never mind 200 years ago, but what it was even 50 years ago, 100 years ago. And so this is a sector and an industry that greatly outperforms itself in terms of the number of people involved and the amount of, you could say, liquid capital that's involved. And still, they're a valuable asset, both in terms of their local communities, and because let's face it too, small towns, whether they're in America or England or here, or indeed in parts of continental Europe, you know, because obviously we've got, we'll obviously touch on the Dutch farmers and that sort of stuff and the French. Agriculture is the backbone of how basically non-major urban centers sort of survive. If there's a cultural aspect to it, there's a nutritional aspect to it, there's a like a market and, you know, financial aspect to it, whereby businesses in small towns depend on farmers. And, you know, indeed, if you get down to the real nitty-gritty level of, you know, the demand for a library, the demand for schools, the demand for employees to service people who live in those towns, much revolves around agriculture. If you destroy small farm, small holding, you know, family farm agriculture, you completely destroy a way of life. And I think not enough people think on that.
Can I just jump in there? Because there's something interesting here where this is all being positioned narrative-wise as it's a trade thing. You know, this is about, you know, we can maximize our economy through outsourcing. That's effectively the line that this guy's saying. But there's an interesting darker piece to Marx's point about where this is about really, and again, tying into your Leninist ideas about the liquidation of the kulaks. Because if this was the same case as the coal miners, for example, which was a small group of people were holding the country to ransom through striking, etc., and through prices. I mean, that's obviously not happening. The farmers aren't doing that. The farmers aren't manipulating prices. They're trying to do their best to have the, you know, the lowest cost possible. But look at the way that they've targeted them. The inheritance tax isn't an economic policy. It's a specific policy to destroy a type of farmer as well. You know, this isn't targeting every, like the you know, farms owned in corporation and businesses. It's farmed owned by people, farms owned by people passing it down. So it's interesting how there's a top level narrative, which is this is an economic thing. We're going to get better value for money by importing. But there is a deeper part to this, which is we're targeting a specific kind of farmer. We're trying to destroy a way of life and a type of people. And again, like Marcus said, there is an entire ecosystem. There is an entire web of people tied to those farms. That's the only thing keeping many small towns and villages across the UK going right now. And I think this is a direct attack against that way of life. I think they want to destroy it. They want to disrupt it. And, you know, Morgoth mentioned something about, turning every town and village in England into some kind of asylum seeker city, you know, that the Londonification of the entire countryside. And I think that is the true goal of this. It's not a fair analogy to talk about coal miners.
Yeah, there's a couple of other aspects to this as well. So I was actually talking to a guy who owns a farm last night, and he said, okay, the protest is one thing, but the reality is that if the farmers decided that they, you know, because let's face it, it's their entire livelihood, it's their entire way of life, right? If the government really tries to push them on this, he said they could just pour all their milk down the drain, let the crops go to, you know, because if they're going to fuck them over anyway, they could just destroy the food stock and London would starve within 3 days, he reckons. Is that true, Marcus? Or would the government try to be like shipping in, you know, tomatoes from somewhere else or something to prevent? Like, could the farmers starve out London if they really wanted to?
The thing is that, well, and it's obviously something that's crossed my mind as well, because I sort of have found myself in this predicament, you know, in terms of the thought process of this sort of, you know, mentality and feeling like farmers are a bit powerless and like, what can farmers do? And there is a point to say that, you know, if farmers, and the thing is, it'd have to almost be at the entire class level. Like, you know, it wouldn't work if, say, a third of farmers did it, a quarter of farmers would do it. Like 90% of farmers would have to do something like this for such a thing to work. But if they were to withhold all of their livestock and all their grain and all their produce, you know, the thing is, a city like London probably has the financial ability to import things. But in the end, that would be sort of a bit comparable to, say, you know, like what was it, the airlift into Tempelhof Airport during the blockade, you know, in East Berlin or West Berlin in the 50s. But that's only doable for like a certain amount of time. That's not feasible long term. That's not feasible, you know, much beyond, say, a year or so. Because you've still got systems that depend on, you know, the networking of, you know, farmers, distributors, you know, millers, bakers, butchers, all that sort of stuff that depend. There's sort of all these second and third tier industries that depend on something like farming, much in the same way, like, you know, with mining, you have, you know, smelters and, you know, smiths and, you know, manufacturing and all that sort of stuff, right? They're sort of like derivative beneficiaries of the of that industry. There's that factor to consider. But I think what you're proposing is probably more... sorry, someone said London Airlift 2024, maybe laugh. But you know, it'd be that is, I think, a more applicable example in some ways to like America, where there's like a large number of these urban centers. And also, you know, America is very much a still a food producing giant, whereas the United Kingdom, from what I've seen in the last, what, 20 or 30 years, food production in the United Kingdom has diminished. And the United Kingdom has become increasingly more of a net food importer. So you might say that the British government has already geared itself towards a degree of economic independence from their own farmers, which gives them leverage, if you get my meaning.
I think they would survive. I think you could easily hold out. You know, there's only the Channel, you've got the Eurostar. They would just put everyone on ration. They would basically, you'd put everyone on rationing, basic food and import stuff. I think they could do it, basically. I think you'd get minimum damage. I think the biggest power that the farmers have is disrupting infrastructure, you know, just like that's, and again, watching what the Dutch did, they were able to close down motorways, close down walkways. It's very difficult to you know, move tractors, etc. And again, that kind of it's the coordinated minority, that's what worked so well for the Dutch strategy. They have to go all in, and I think my concern is I don't know if you saw that the National Union of Farmers was saying not to go and protest, for example. If they're going to do this, they need to hit really hard and to make a big financial loss and to show that look, we can turn out. Again, ironically they're going to be turning the farmers into coal miners in the sense that they need to make the people pay. And then that's the only way they can have power. But I don't think it is through the restricting of food, because also it affects the wrong people as well. That affects, you know, will rich people or whatever, will the establishment or regime stooges suffer from a food shortage? Probably not. But they will suffer, you know, their stocks will suffer, their businesses will suffer if you block roadways, etc., and disrupt infrastructure.
So there's two other things I want to say on this, which are important, I think. The first thing is that most of the really catastrophic humanitarian disasters of the past 100 years have happened when governments try to mess with the kulaks and the farm and exactly the small farmers that guy was talking about. I have a series of videos that I made years ago on Zimbabwe when they did the land reform there. They called it land reform. But basically what that was, Marcus, was taking farms from people who've had those farms for hundreds of years and handing them over to some government douchebag, right? Some government lackey who then didn't know what to do with it.
Yeah.
And what happened? A catastrophic famine in Zimbabwe, in Ethiopia, you know, you remember Live Aid and the famine and so on. What they didn't mention is that they had a hardcore Marxist-Leninist government that took the farmers, that took the land off the farmers and did land redistribution. The Holodomor in Ukraine under Stalin was literally this. China under Mao had a problem before Deng's reforms. They had a problem where they couldn't work out how to do the farm production. And what Deng's quote-unquote genius was to basically just give it back, give it back to to the actual farmers, right?
Redistribution.
right. So I mean, this is one of those things that wherever it has been tried in history, it leads to absolute catastrophe. And on the point of importing food, Venezuela in their absolute genius, okay, they went from a model where they thought, right, our big thing is oil now, so we're going to get out of the business of making food and we're going to go all in on oil. Okay, so Venezuela in real time became a net importer of food. Well, it wasn't that long after that point that the Venezuelans were eating from literally rubbish bins. Do you remember those images?
And they killed the animals in their own zoos, like literally to eat meat.
Right, that's how desperate they were for food.
Yeah,
because they all of a sudden they were relying on imports and they didn't have food security. One shock to the oil market and they were fucked, basically. So I hear the point that the elites could probably get away in the short term with, you know, rerouting or getting the food from some other country, but that is not a long-term sustainable solution. Second thing I wanted to mention is that in any situation like, you know, like with the miners versus the government, there was always that the government can play this game where the public can turn, right? So, i.e., if they're disruptive enough, the public then stop supporting the people who are striking and they start supporting the government against the strikers. Okay, and this was a dynamic that Thatcher played with a lot, okay?
The loss of goodwill against the downtrodden, so to speak.
Right. The trouble is that this Labour government is historically, and I mean historically, unpopular. Keir Starmer, and this was before the budget and before any of this shit happened as well, was at minus 38, okay? Probably the real figure is even worse than that for Starmer.
That's actually quite remarkable when you consider how recent the election was as well. Like, he's not even had a honeymoon period, really, like to speak
of. He is already less popular than Rishi Sunak was at the bottom of his popularity, right? So he is historic. And when I say Keir Starmer is hated, he is viscerally hated, not just by me, but every single person watching this show and anybody I've ever met. I haven't met a single person who likes Keir Starmer at all. Not just Southport either. It's a whole range of issues. It's like he is going on a speed run to alienate every segment of society. Old people, fucking people who own pubs, farmers now. It's like he's going on the, who can I fuck over next, you know? Now, as against Clarkson, who not only is arguably the most popular person in this country, but I was just before this show having a look to see just how big Clarkson's farm is. Do you know that Clarkson's farm is the most watched television show in the entire world? It's big not just here, it's big in America. The views for Clarkson's farm are 9.5 times bigger than the average US TV show in America.
That's actually stupendous. Holy hell.
Clarkson's farm is big in China, of all places. They absolutely love it over there. I was talking to a guy last night who has business in the Middle East and so on, and he was talking about being in this situation where, there are a couple of kids, 8 and 12, and they were thinking, well, what can we put on for everybody to watch? And the 8-year-old was like, let's watch Clarkson, right? These are like Arabic kids in bloody Oman, and they love Clark, right? So what I'm saying is you've got a historically unpopular prime minister up against somebody not with just national-level fame, but international level fame, and specifically famous, not just for Top Gear now, but for owning a farm and for introducing the entire world to the problems that British farmers are facing. Right? I mean, I kind of chuckled to myself, like the idea of some random guy in China trying to get his head around the complexities of British tax system or whatever. But, you know, this is the truth of it. So he has a platform basically that could actually turn the entire world against Keir Starmer. And I mean, Trump already has said that he doesn't particularly like the guy. Farage is there. You know, I mean, there is basically a perfect storm waiting to brew. And this is why I'm kind of, okay, my hopes are too much. But this could, when I said Clarkson could change British politics, this could go very wrong for the government if they really go for this. But anyway, go on, Mark.
Not to interrupt, I just want to make the point also. This is occurring at the same time where you've had a general election where a genuine, let's call it a fourth party, because technically the Lib Dems are the third party in Great Britain, a genuine fourth party entity, although they only did get themselves a couple of seats, but Reform did garner a large number of votes in the previous general election. You've got a force there under Farage and Tice that could potentially, you know, absorb a lot of disenchanted voters, both from those who have lost hope in the Tories and those who have disdain for Labour. That's occurring at the same time as this controversy here and this popularity with Clarkson. You've actually got quite the perfect storm for discontent against the way things are, so to speak.
Yes, absolutely. Anything else on this story before we move on to talking a little bit about Trump, and then we'll have to get to the Q&A?
I do have one thing, but I'll pass it over to Pharaoh. So you go, Pharaoh, and then I'll come in after.
Thanks, yeah. I think what's going to be interesting is seeing how Clarkson reacts to the protests, how much he takes part, whether he is becomes that kind of central figurehead and voice of the farmers. I've often felt that he feels amongst them, but maybe a bit of a fraud, or not a fraud, so to speak, but doesn't feel the true authenticity compared to, you know, people that have been generational farmers. And I would say to him and his camp that he sort of needs to throw off those notions, because I think that there's a specific moment happening here, and he is the mouthpiece of the farmers, whether he likes it or not. And it's for him to step forward and to represent their views and represent the pains that they suffer. Now, I think the other question is, how will Labour respond to this? And, you know, you think it's going to be this potentially interesting moment of challenging the government. I don't think that is the case. I feel that the Labour Party are happy to be despised. I think Keir is happy to be the most unpopular man in England. And I think he's going to go nowhere, because there is no pressure. There's no pressure internally for him to leave. Short of severe economic problems caused by the farmer protests, literally breaking society down, I don't think he'll go. I don't think, again, like I've said before, Blair will not take direct control. He will remove people from the cabinet. He will swap people around. But Keir will always stay. And I think that's the fundamental problem. He is exceptionally stubborn. He will double down. But I think this is one of these big test moments. Let's see, will Clarkson step up to the plate? And what will be his rhetoric around it? And what will the Labour government's response be? But I'm relatively pessimistic. I feel like they're happy to be despised. That the fact that that guy even said that publicly on a news channel, you know, the clip at the beginning, for example, and he didn't feel like the need to self-censor, shows where they're at mentally. And I feel they know that they're not going to get moved or budged, so they feel like they can roll out these big policies.
I'm actually wondering if I can't remember a government that is so just hostile to the country like this. Not like actively just kind of happy to be hated. I honestly think they're running the risk of actual revolt at this point. Because, I mean, there has to be, remember what I said before the election. The sensible thing to do was to, you know, the adults are back in the room. And all of that stuff's gone out the window, really, because we're dealing with a psychopath, essentially, Pharaoh, right? Not just one psychopath. Yes. I think Rachel Reeves is a psychopath as well.
Definitely, yeah.
The whole cabinet is full of them.
And Angela's an actual idiot, for example. It's possibly the most disgusting and despicable selection of politicians we've ever had. But so what? You know, who's going to push them out? They will only move from an internal revolution, and Blair won't do that, and no one else will do that, because they've purged all of the Corbynites. So my view is, short of, like you said, a literal physical revolution, which I don't think will happen, by the way, because not enough middle class people are being affected right now, if I'm honest with you. I think you'll just get some disorganized protests going on at most. I think it won't be enough for a full on enough pressure on the government, and the military certainly won't do anything. So I think they're going to double down. I think from their perspective, they don't have to care about the polls anymore. That's the thing about being despised. Once you're despised, you know, again, it's again all the way back to Machiavelli again. It's better to be feared than to be loved if you cannot be both. You know, they don't care about the love anymore. So all they can do is to be feared. You know, I in this situation, you know, why not go? Why not be the villain of the piece?
Sorry, Farrow, on your point, I've just seen to see what Starmer's up to see what, you know, he's just announced that by 2035, he wants to cut UK carbon emissions by 81%.
Yeah.
In the next 10 years, 81% by 2035. Anyway, carry on. Sorry.
No. And he's we are the only people in the globe doing this now. Again, it feels like we're singing, you know, yesterday's tunes. But the other question I wonder is just how far Clarkson would go, and just how he would push. And I still think that there is no such thing as a base boomer, and I think he would chicken out, and I think he would only go so far. And I don't think his generation is mentally able to deliver what is needed in this situation. But we'll see. I mean, I'd love to be proven wrong, but on top of the
81%, he's just, I mean, I don't want to get into a whole discussion about this, but he's also just said Ukraine is going to be in the strongest position possible before Trump takes over, type thing. I mean, it's just like, I don't know. I really don't think that they're living in reality, this government, that they've just, I mean, they are not operating. And this is not a normal government, is it? They are not operating with the normal incentives of politicians. It's like, I mean, I've said before, it's like the Terminator's in. He's there to do a job and he just doesn't give a fuck anymore. He's just going to be like, exactly. My job is to destroy this country in record time. But Marcus, any final thoughts before we move on?
Yeah, I do have a couple of points. I'll try and power through them as quickly as possible. Just if we cast the mind back to when we did streams, that would have been at least 18 months ago now. We did a couple of streams with our dear friend Ferro here, and our friend Tristan joined us. We did like the vegan meat-free agenda. You know, there's I think two streams we did, and we were meant to do more, but we never got around to it. But those streams have actually become quite pertinent to this discussion, because the points that we raise in our circles, and rightly so, about, you know, when socialists do this sort of thing, you know, whether it's the Holodomor and the Kulaks, whether it's communist China, the post-cultural revolution, you know, Venezuela, wherever it happens, there's always this inevitable famine when you engage in the land redistribution, the liquidation, the Kulaks. You know, you lose the skills, you lose the ability to work the land and to, you know, properly engage in that industry and have the productivity necessary to feed the people. I think in the back of my mind, this is actually one of many reasons, but certainly one of the key reasons why we have seen such a proliferation of what we call like food products and the food industry in the last 50 years, or at least like in our lifetimes, and this massive lurch towards moving away from actual real food towards food products. And as an extension of that, this is why we have like, you know, the lab meat stuff, you know, the artificial meat, you know, the vegan push, you know, substituting, you know, beef with tofu and that sort of stuff, is that by what means can we reduce as much as possible the necessity of farmers to engage in agricultural practice? If we can just make most of this stuff in factories, you know, alongside maybe a bit of battery farming, which can be, you know, can be trusted to corporations and their minions, then the actual necessity of small family farms, you know, landholders with local knowledge and understanding of, you know, soils and crop rotation and husbandry and all that sort of stuff ends up becoming completely, you know, made redundant, then that's a vital part of that jigsaw puzzle, in my opinion. We could go into that another time, but that's just something that has come to mind since we've been talking, and something I've been actually thinking about for a little while. Another thing I wanted to raise too is because there's been like some talk about, oh, is Clarkson our guy, not our guy, whatever. But someone said in the chat recently that Clarkson is perhaps materializing himself as a rival castle, and I think that might be true rather than actually necessarily being our guy. But there's something to be said, and I'm not actually going to make a comparison to Caesar as such, but just the phenomena of a man of the hour. Always remember that, you know, like a person of yesteryear is not the person they are now, firstly, And secondly, you know, like, the man who crossed the Rubicon was not the politician he was 15 years prior. Caesar became himself because he was as much pushed as he was pulling people. You know, behind him were his veterans and the plebs, and perhaps a growing disdain for his class. And then on the inversely, he was being pushed into a corner by his fellow senators. He was being, you know, demands were being made of him. He was essentially being put into a position, whereas if he did not basically engage in warfare against the Republic, he would be put on a, you know, he'd be given a kangaroo trial and more or less exiled or executed. Now, I'm not saying Clarkson's in that position necessarily, but if he's earning the enmity of his own peers, meanwhile, he has a class of people pushing behind him, you could have that similar phenomena of he's being pushed into a position and he's also being pulled.
No, but
in the end, whether Clarkson acts on that is another thing altogether.
It's just dreaming. I feel like there's just we're so thirsty and so hungry for someone to
stand up. I'm not saying it's inevitable. I'm not attacking you on this,
but I'm just saying in general.
Of course.
People see the Caesar in him, but I don't at all. He's not backed into a corner. This guy will still have a whole load of cash. He'll still have his family. He'll still have his holdings. And this is the fundamental problem. Unless he's being existentially attacked by the regime, you know, unless he's being called out by name by the regime, he will forever be on the reservation because his livelihood will forever be safe. And I think he will only take things so far. Now, if say, for example, there was an actual argument between him and the government and they were trying to legislate against him, then I think, you know, then he might take some of those steps. But again, I think generationally that generation is just doesn't have the capacity to lead in that kind of way because they always seem to bottle it at the last minute. Or again, take things so far, or again, question themselves. And I feel like there is just something fundamental. That, again, Clarkson has that. He has the charisma, he has the diction and the rhetoric, but he doesn't have the fundamental heroism. And that's what I think is missing from that entire generation.
On that basis, we'll just have to wait and see. All I was merely explaining was like the phenomenon. I'm not saying it was inevitably going to happen. Can I just, one last quick thing, AO? Because it does pertain to Australia. Is that we entered a minority government here. So Labor came in 2007 under Kevin Rudd, who's actually currently our US ambassador, and he's in the news for a whole bunch of reasons because he tweeted shit about Trump and now he's had to delete them because he's still the ambassador, which is hilarious. But anyway, he became PM in 07, and then he was couped by the Labor Party here, and they installed one Julie Gillard, who contested the 2010 election. Now, that became a hung parliament in which there were, I think, four independents, and three of them sided with Gillard in order to form like a Labour minority government. And those three members of the lower house all came from rural seats. And the members of, I'm trying to think what it was, New England was one of them, and I can't remember the other seat. They would never in their right mind have ever voted left wing or Labour, but their own representatives, their own parliamentarians basically put them in a corner, deprived them of their voice, and formed a minority government with Labour. And as a result of that, and also 2010 was a year where we had, I think Queensland had a huge flood and there was a massive drought in Western Australia and agriculture had gone through a hard period. Farmers around the country actually organised something they call a convoy of no confidence, and they, like, trucks from around the country converged on Canberra. And the reason I actually wanted to raise this point is because Anthony Albanese is our current Prime Minister in Australia. And at the time, he was just he had a portfolio. I can't remember what portfolio was, but he was in a part of the Rudd Gillard ministries. And I remember him standing up in Parliament, and it's just singed in my brain. And he mocked the farmers by saying it was the convoy of no consequence. And ultimately, the convoy went to Canberra. There was a few interviews. They sort of held their placards. They, you know, shouted a little bit, as is their right to do. But then, like, eventually it fizzled out. Everyone went home and nothing changed. There was no fundamental changes. The policies in this country have only been increasingly hostile towards agriculture. The point I'm trying to make is, if farmers in England are going to, or Britain are going to make a fuss, they have to do it like the French and the Dutch. You have to go the full 12 yards, and you have to basically either have political representation or force like the government into concessions, and you have to force them to blink, because in the end, I hate to deride my fellow Australian farmers here, but a week, not even a week, but like a gesture that doesn't achieve any, you know, gains is not worthwhile. If you're going to go to all the fuss of doing it, it has to be worthwhile. That's all I wanted to say.
Yeah, I'll just say very quickly before we move on from this, on the previous exchange that you guys had, all the best heroes are reluctant, though. I'll just say that. And I hear what Pharaoh's saying, that Clarkson's, you know, he's comfortable and, you know, but he could be the reluctant hero, you know. I was just interested to see if Alicia Kearns is on this, because I remember she...
Pork Pie Queen.
Yeah, the Pork Pie Queen. And in fairness to Alicia Kearns, she has retweeted the horrible interview that we played at the start. So some of those rural Tory MPs are on this. And in fact, I would argue that Farage is dropping the ball on this. He 100%. Should be all over this front and center. He should be going down there, but he's not.
He's given up, I swear, literally. We got so much good coverage on the run-up to the election, and then after that, again, everything he should be following up time and time and time again, but he doesn't. You know, we don't get those little vox pops. You know, when they have the was it the South Hall kids fighting or whatever? He was doing the little from his desk. He should be doing that every single time something bad happens with a Labour government. We haven't seen a single one. You know, he's spending his time just whining and dining with Trump in America right now.
No, he's talking. Do you know what he's doing? He's moaning about he wasn't allowed to go to the cenotaph. Listen, Nigel, nobody cares about that. They care about this. And he's just completely failing to, you know, we have a historically shit Tory party and probably the least popular government in our lifetimes right now. So Farage should be absolutely knocking it out of the park, and he's doing nothing. When Seb Gorka called him a cuck on Lotus Eaters, I fist pumped. In fact, the entire office was just like, whoa, because it was...
Based Gorka.
everything that everybody's feeling at the moment about Farage. He's just completely... This is his moment, and he's just not grasping it at all. Which I'm afraid, Pharaoh, is another data point for your no boomer can step up, basically, idea.
Just one last thing on that, because you mentioned about the reluctant hero. I don't like he is reluctant, but just being reluctant doesn't make you a hero. I think it's something intrinsic to your character, and that is the ability to have vision and to chase that and to bring people along with you on that, at the expense of everything. And I just feel like one of the big problems with boomers is that they're just tied to stuff and to people and their own status, and they're not willing to sacrifice at all. The whole point of going on the Rubicon is Caesar said, I'm going to risk everything for something bigger. And I just don't think that Clarkson will do that.
I also think, by the way, that whatever the next government is that comes in, whether it's Tory, Reform, fucking Lib Dem, I don't care. Whatever the next government is after this Labour government has to pass an immediate bill, basically like Men in Black, retconning, you woke up from a bad dream, just like an anti-Starmer bill that undoes everything. Because I'm just having a look, I'm just keeping an eye on what they're up to. They're trying to push through assisted dying now, right? This is the next vote they're going to do.
Yeah.
This is
what I'm saying, that they know they're hated. So if you're reviled by everyone and you're politically safe, why not drop every single bill that you've always wanted to do, just your darkest desires laid out, if you know that you're safe? And I think that's the situation they feel. They're like, screw the public, screw public opinion, screw PR. Everyone hates us anyway, so let's just go for it. Let's just go all in.
I tell you what, they're just honestly, I mean, I'd go further. I'd just ban the Labour Party at this point. I think the Democrats in America should be banned as well for what they've done to that country. Anyway, speaking of a boomer who did step up, Pharaoh, what about Mr. Donald Trump, who is a boomer, was already a billionaire, and in some ways has that bit of the reluctant hero about him? He is now not only completed a historic sweep, every single swing state, big victory. It's not quite Nixon or Reagan 84, but it's a big victory in recent history. And they've done the trifecta. They've got the Republicans have got the House, they've got the Senate. You know, basically they can do whatever they want now. They've got an opportunity, a golden opportunity. And, you know, he's appointed a guy on immigration who is known for, you know, when people object to deporting deporting illegal immigrants, what about the children? His response is, well, we deport the children too, which made me fist bump. So the Republicans now, all three, all, you know, the House, the Senate, and the presidency. And basically they've got the Supreme Court too, because there's still 6-3 on the court. So they control every branch of government, every the legislative, everything. And they've got the, it's actually even more than a trifecta, they've got the governors as well. They won the state-level governors. So they basically have not total power in America, but as big opportunity as they will ever get to do something now in the next year, next 2 years. Do we think that they can make America great again? And I'll start with Marcus this time, and then I'll go to Pharaoh. Marcus, how are you, what are you thinking about Trump's America?
The thing is, I think this comes down to personality too, is that I think with Trump, I'm still unconvinced that he's going to go the full sort of 12 yards. But, you know, as you say, there's indicated and revealed preferences. And I mean, in the end, if we start seeing some heavy hitting stuff, you know, like for instance, if the JFK files were to get declassified, if RFK gets put in the administration, just starts like tearing the FDA to shreds, and we start to see results, you know, the wall gets finished, they start dealing, you know, and when I say dealing, I mean really dealing with the alien problem, or, you know, the immigration issue, then we can count them as genuine W's. But until that comes to pass, and let's, I mean, and as we know, let's say Clarkson, Trump doesn't take office until January, it's all theoretical. But so far, at least the indications appear good. Like you say, these first couple of appointees and friends, what was his name? Homan, I think, the new borders are. It's impressive, and it indicates the right sort of the right kind of way that Trump needs to sort of go with these things. But we just have to, in the end, we just have to see from here on in. But it is positive, at least looking from the outset.
Now, I will say there's been a lot of moaning online about his very pro-Israeli picks, but that was always baked into the cake, right? We knew that. That's why I predicted for Trump, because I knew that he, you know, made a deal with that lot. But the thing is that, this is, the deal has to be this, and it has to be this. There's no, I mean, I think I saw somebody saying America doesn't have time to fuck about with containment anymore. Okay. Yes, you can have your Israel stuff, right? But when it comes to doing the base stuff, Ben Shapiro has to shut up. And all of the containment crew have to just get behind the domestic agenda. You get your Israel bit, but do not counter signal based world stuff that Trump wants to do. Do you think they're going to be able to do it? Do you think Ben Shapiro is going to be able to not counter signal, or not just Ben Shapiro, all of those fuckwits, basically, who are in on this ticket for Israel? Let's face it, there are people who are on this ticket for the Israel bit. Will they be able to stop it being the cuck-servative when it comes to the domestic agenda? And Marcus, I'll ask you, and then I'll, Farah, you can come in on all of it. Mm-hmm. Cool.
Let's just say past experience leads us to think no, because ungrateful people rarely change their stripe. But again, we will wait and see. I mean, a few guys in the chat are saying that Shapiro's going, you know, full in on MAGA. So, you know, maybe they will. Maybe they're willing to make that trade-off. Maybe the crumbs are enough. If they get what they want on that one particular issue, maybe they'll fall in line with the other stuff. Because let's face it, if things don't domestically change in America, you know, during this 1-4 year period, I don't see there being another opportunity going forward, frankly speaking.
Pharaoh, your assessment, sir.
Just a couple of things. Firstly, about your point that, you know, Trump is this activated boomer. I would say that the situation is different because it's obvious that his entire livelihood was being attacked by other politicians. You know, all of the court staff. He was being attacked in the media. It's an existential crisis for him. If I'm honest with you, you know, it was him. If either he wins, or I think he probably was going to go to jail or have severe fines. I know all your blue and on stuff, etc. It's part of the show. Whatever. He was being specifically targeted. And I think it would have had severe impact with his life and with his family. So I think it's a different situation. But also, I think the energy behind Trump this time around is much more Gen X. It's your Elon and your Vance, etc. And again, Elon, another character where if they didn't win, Twitter would have been severely fined. I think they would have tried to dismantle the Elon empire, as it were. So I think he had to go with all in. So I think it's a slightly different situation, and I think the fundamental energy behind it is the Gen X energy more than anything else. Regarding the deal that's at stake, you get Israel, we get the domestic policy. We've seen this play out in Europe with several of the parliamentary parties. Maloney or Geert Wilders, for example. And I think, for example, with Maloney, it's been tepid, but it has been working so far. I think the issue is, are there going to be moments when those two areas collide? So for example, Trump says, Israel, do your thing. And they flatten the whole of Israel, flatten Gaza, flatten the Palestinians, and want, it creates a humanitarian crisis, and they want to ship those people out. What happens then? America has to do their fair share, and I think in those situations, the Israel camp is going to expect to trump the domestic camp, and that's going to create a huge source of tension and an issue. So I think it will work in the short term, but I think there are going to be moments of clash, and which one of those groups can gain power during that time. Now I think there are a few interesting sub elements to this. You've mentioned this before. Like, just how based is Elon Musk? Just how based is the Trump team after BB screwed him over? I'm not sure about this, like about how petty-minded Trump is. Even with all of this, the Lammy stuff and basically every single Labour Party MP slagging him off, he's reacted very graciously to it. And again, I don't know whether this is just his experience as a businessman, where you basically in business, you basically have to not care what people say, what people about you, as long as you make the deal. Do you know what I'm saying? You have to put those things behind you. But will Trump hold a grudge against people? Will he hold it? And will he use that at some point? I'm not sure. And I think that's the interesting thing. So.
Yeah. Okay. Great. I also think that people need to remember why Elon Musk went to Auschwitz in the first place, right? I mean, you don't just forget about those things. What do they do? Like, put him in the Clockwork Orange machine, so he forgot all of the things that he was talking about before that. I also want to point out that what I mentioned before, on the night of the election, Tucker Carlson was on broadcasting live from Mar-a-Lago. Tucker Carlson, if anybody, he doesn't even hide his power levels. He's got all the power levels at this point. I struggle to believe that, and he regularly talks to Douglas McGregor. When Robert Barnes went on the Duran, he mentioned that lots of Trump's inner team don't watch the TV anymore. They watch the Duran, right? I struggle to believe that people who are regularly watching the Duran and talking to Douglas McGregor and so on aren't aware. Right. Like, so I'm just saying that it's not a done deal that everything is going to go Ben Shapiro's way here. We already saw Shapiro got egg on his face when he called that Mike Pompeo would be in the administration, and Trump completely ruled that out, and Nikki Haley. Now, he has put some other pretty hardcore Zionists in key positions in the past day or so, but I guess there's some give and take there, right? There's some give and take. And it's, yeah, it'll be interesting. I think people shouldn't get too, like, caught up on this idea until the data is in, basically, because we don't know how it's going to go.
Yeah,
exactly. You know, the guy who brought Daryl Cooper onto his show is just going to be like a complete pushover, you know, or Elon, or you know. So I'm just saying that there is, he has leverage. Let's face it, he has become the most powerful person in the entire world, and Elon Musk is probably like number two at this point, you know. So,
yeah. Just on that again, if you think about just from a information and propagandizing point of view, let's just call them Team Shapiro. Team Shapiro, you know, they had the press, they had TV, and whatever, and movies, for example, traditional media. The younger generation are using that less and less. Where, what are they using? They're using X. They're using social media. They're using online platforms. And actually, Team Tucker and that little group, I think, has more leverage over the younger generation. So if anything, I see the Shapiroite stars waning in strength just from a propagandization perspective. So, you know, can they do to fix something to fix that for the long term? I don't know. But as we've seen, for example, with M-based TikTok, etc., they have a big problem with the younger generation. And again, what happens when the boomers go? Because I think that's their strongest like people power block, and they're about to die in the next 10 years or so. So I don't know if the time horizons will work out for, as you say, that kind of battle.
Yeah. And I can see people in the chat saying, oh, they've got levers they can pull. I mean, listen, they haven't been able to bring Trump down in a decade at this point. They couldn't bring him down when he was out of office. Now he's in office. They couldn't bring him down last time. Now he's got a whole team and a bunch of security around him.
Also,
Trump has won.
Count too. Well, and also, like, it's insofar as the democracy is concerned, or well, a republic to be specific with America, a complete victory insofar that, you know, senators, the House, you know, popular vote. Basically, there's no chinks in the armor of this electoral win for Trump as well. Like, there's nothing that can be undermined in the you know, superficial sense. If you get my meaning.
Yeah, and I've just seen, sorry to go back to the previous story, but I've just seen something that has made me, what is Nigel Farage talking about today? He's done one of his addresses from the office, right? Farage has, to come back to the previous story. Mm-hmm. Have a guess what he's talking about.
Fisheries, maybe? I know the channel.
Justin Welby has got to go, the Archbishop of Canterbury. Oh. That's what he's leading with? He's not Vital leading with news. A fucking... Yeah, Justin Welby's got to go. I mean, fucking hell.
It's interesting. It's really interesting, like, why he doesn't, like, what he covers and what he doesn't. I don't know. It's not politically sensible, in my opinion.
He's being advised by fucking morons. I tell you what, Nigel. Rather than just sack off your advisors and just watch this channel and do what I tell you to do. Fuck's sake. I mean, just get behind Clarkson, you moron. Anyway, sorry. I just saw that and it just kind of it just pissed me off.
but just on that point, very briefly, it's worth, like, what is confounding is that, you know, you think like reform sort of came together quite late in the piece. That election was called, and sort of all that happened in pretty swift succession. And Farage said as much in the, you know, the few days leading up to the election. And to be honest with you, by any sort of decent, you know, metric, reform did quite well considering, right? And it's worth saying that, you know, with the whole no seats thing that, you know, yourself, AA, you know, those ads which were freaking hilarious, and all the energy that was there on X and whatever that, you know, that sort of pertained to that topic, you know, it's worth saying there was a good deal of wind in their sails. And for what? What the hell are they doing with it? What the hell is Farage doing with it? You know, he has such notoriety as being sort of Mr. Brexit and having sort of, you know, given people in Britain sort of like a legitimate third choice from the two major parties. And I have never seen a man so swiftly sit on his own hands. It's perplexing, you know, considering what he could be doing otherwise.
Sorry, I'm so incensed. I'm tweeting at him right now. It's really pissed me off. It's kind of like, what the fuck? The Archbishop of Canterbury. Jesus.
Like, the Canterbury thing is like, it's important, but that should be like a tweet, not a video. Do you know what I'm saying? It's like, he should definitely get rid of. But just while you're doing that, I want to talk about interesting non-parallel from the Dutch. That, you know, it's interesting how the Dutch were able to turn that movement into a political force. We just don't have the capacity to do that in the UK because of our because of the electoral system that we have. You know, any kind of political power that the farmers are going to get have to be attached to one of those three existing parties. So again, now would be the perfect time for Farage to pick up a huge number of votes from people who wouldn't necessarily vote for them, and to bring them into the fold. Why don't you get Clarkson as head of agriculture or something like that? You know, just some kind of or like speaker for agriculture. We'll have farmers representation in the party. It's just so easy to monitor to kind of tap into all of the energy around this and use it, but he's not doing it.
Yeah,
useless, fucking useless. Anyway, let's hit some of the questions from this past week. Oh God, I mean, it would be nice for somebody to step up, and really, it should be Nigel. It's his moment to step up, and it's like he's standing in front of a wide open goal. Wide open. The keeper's gone. You know when the keeper goes up for a corner, right? And you know, somebody lobs it down the other end and there's no defenders or anything there. Striker standing right in front of the goal, you know, and it's just like, oh, he's ballooned it. Oh, he's hit it right into the corner. Fucking useless, I tell you. Anyway, let's have a look at these super thanks then, and then I'll hit some of the super chats. We'll do the Q&A. Where do we get? Somebody sent a super thanks on a very old video of mine called The Intractable Problem of Democracy, which actually dates, I don't know how old is that video. It must be about 10 years old, that video, at this point. That's not a recent one. That was made well before I even thought of writing Populist Illusion. Date on there, March the 28th, 2018. A lifetime ago. But anyway, Lincoln Rail Split says thanks. And he's a fellow Aussie of yours. He's another Aussie.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
Okay, so what else have we got? On Donald Trump wins huge, Kamala Harris is a complete jobber. Dissident Knight has sent 100 Australian dollars, another Australian. So that's probably about 50 quid if I had to work it out. Al Dandy.
Possibly 20 nowadays.
Al Dandy, indeed. I saw a lot of predictions, some even emphatic. No man backed his talk as vehemently as this fellow. A thankless job, I imagine. Your analysis and insight are impactful. For this, I thank you, sir. Well, thank you very much, Dissident Mike. The Devastator says, your predictions are accurate, AA. Congratulations on the win, and I look forward to seeing you take that cigar from Auron. Well, at this point, I would like to think that honesty, decency, sportsmanship, and a good old-fashioned sense of fair play would kick in, and Auron would just, you know, give up. Unfortunately, Auron, I mean, honestly, it's getting Talmudic. You have to just... to try to lawyer this out at this point, just accept the loss, mate. You know, that's why there's only a good sport. There's only one cigar, only like $50 or something. Just, you've lost. You know, my win conditions were met. It's over. It's just not cricket, I tell you. Sherlock Holmes. Well, it's not. I mean, if it was me, if it had gone the other way and Kamala Harris had a thumping win and everybody was saying, like, Woke had won, I'd be like, all right, I lost. But that didn't happen, did it? Sherlock Holmes says, with Trump winning, I mean, it's getting to the point where, like, CNN and The Spectator are literally just declaring the Woke is over, and he's still not having it. How can you lawyer it out at this point? I tell you, that is a culture that has been ruined by legalism and people suing each other and so on. You know, this is like I made the bet in the spirit of Phileas Fogg, for God's sake. Anyway, Herlock Sholmes says, with Trump winning the election, most right wingers believe that populism could change the world. But this turned out to be an illusion. You should make a video reminding people about the message of the populist illusion. Also, thanks for predicting this win. It feels good to be able to see what the media and the experts couldn't see. Yeah, well, you see, the thing is that the message of the populist illusion was not that populism could never win, but that if populism was going to win, it had to become an organized minority, right? Because Trump, in last time, was never in power. He was in office, but he was never in power. And I think that this lot have learned that lesson. Mm. And, you know, given that Mark Andreessen and Vivek Ramaswamy and so on, you know, kind of cite James Burnham here and there, they are elite theory build. Yeah. They've shown it, whether it's through me or Aaron or just through being well-read themselves, they are elite theory build. This is obvious to us now. You know,
have you seen some of those photos where they're all just kind of around a table together? And it's like, yeah, that's literally organization, isn't it? Basically, just people together working together for a goal. And you'd like just from the energy and the vibes in that picture alone, you know they're much much more focused. But we'll see how things pan out. But I think you're right. I think there's definitely a much higher level of organization and focus this time around.
MC Hart 4 says, excellent analysis throughout the election. I should have never doubted. But you will. This is the problem, MC Hart. Next time, the next go round, you'd be like, oh, you were right all those other times, eh? But this time, oh, I've got a different feeling about it. This time, you know, sick of the go round. I'm not going to do anymore. I'm going to retire from predictions, I think. Go out on a high. Ionic Echo says, prediction. I believe that if Trump doesn't play along, he will be taken out and Iran will be blamed. Vance will have no choice but to declare war. Plus, all of the Trump supporters would then be on board. And therefore, no more resistance to the neocon agenda. This is likely another reason why the regime wanted Trump to win. Prop up the sacrificial cow. In order to get the MAGA vote to seek revenge on whoever the regime direct their anger towards. The MAGA crowd are exactly where the regime wants them. Yes, keep this one quiet. Don't want to give them any ideas if they haven't thought of this already. Well, I'll tell you, they've already thought of it because a couple of days after you wrote that, there was that ridiculous Sun headline saying that Iran were behind the assassination attempt on Trump.
Wild.
You know, I mean, Pharaoh, is that the worst regime?
It's the worst. That's the worst narrative build-up of all time, basically. Because again, it's you can do that kind of stuff like at the time in the kind of fog of war. That's the best time to do that before they find out information about the guy. But we know all about him and whatever his political leanings, and they've done all of the research into it. So to kind of rehash a story from the previous year and to pin the blame onto someone else. This actually is quite damaging to their side of things, because I think people will get more sceptical as when people attach blame to Iran for future things now. So this is definitely backfired in terms of its ability to blame Iran. But I think it's more interesting to show that is a narrative that is being floated at all.
I mean, I honestly think that even though the plebs are merely kettle, I do think that this somewhat underestimates or is a little bit insulting to the MAGA base, right? The MAGA base can be a lot of things, but if they're nothing else, they are skeptical about bullshit like this.
Yeah.
Right? I did not, like, let's be fair to the MAGA crew. They ignored this and they still were like, what, Mike Pompeo? Fuck no. Right. So it's not like the MAGA crowd are okay, they're stupid, but they're not stupid. You know what I'm saying?
And also this is like an area that they don't want to do. I think MAGA is fundamentally anti-war. It's isolationist, isn't it, really? So when you're playing on like negative ground, you got to do better than this. Come on, propagandists, you got to do better. Be better. Where they would go to war is if something genuine happened, like another 9/11 style attack. That's when I can see MAGA going into attack mode. But just pinning random stuff on Iran just isn't going to cut the mustard.
Yeah, I also think that it's worth noting that the Shapiro style, the Daily Wire and so on, have nowhere near a monopoly on MAGA media, right? There's Newsmax, there's Duran, there's, you know, Barnes, there's all the kind of quote-unquote based lawyers, there's People's Pundit. I mean, the MAGA... McGregor. I mean, there is a big sphere of
and also Tucker Carlson himself. Like, you know, if anyone's a focal point of MAGA media, it'd be him.
Tucker.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Steve Bannon, of course, as well, is another one. Gawker. Yeah. I mean, Turley. Steve Turley, who I've met twice now, talked to, lovely guy. He's not going to be rah rah, let's have war on Iran. I know the guy. Like, there's just no way that they're going to be able to pull off that psyop with so many independent voices, right? I mean, you could bribe one or two of them.
You can do it, but you'd have to set up like quite a complicated psyop. I think you'd have to like sink a ship or something and then blame the Iranians.
I was going to say Ferry, it'd have to be like a Lusitania style incident.
Yeah,
like,
even if that happened, you know as well as I do that Larry Johnson will be on Judge Knapp the next day being like, this is bullshit, you know. All of the Hawaiian shirt crew would be on Alex Jones being like,
I mean, this is a psyop,
you know.
This is what I was saying going back to you. It's interesting, you know, Musk was going on about whatever, you are the media now or whatever, but the traditional media networks and propaganda control have massively broken down over the last 15 years. And I think that it's going to be more difficult than ever to create these kind of faux narratives without them being challenged and questioned by subject matter experts. So
another point I'd just like to quickly make, just the steel man MAGA for a second as a movement, as a phenomenon, right? Because I sort of remember it like all the way back to 2015 when sort of Trump first entered the room, so to speak. And as someone who's kind of like enthusiastic at the prospect at the time, is that if there's a couple of core principles that sort of I would define MAGA by, it is a rejection of sort of this sort of free market globalized capitalism that we have, and sort of, you know, the consequences of having lived with the Rust Belt. In my opinion, and what you might classify like the so-called Reagan Democrats, or, you know, the working class that have substantially moved towards Trump in the last, 10 years or so. Another aspect would be, I'd probably say non-interventionist more than isolationist, but definitely this war weariness and a tiredness of being dragged into foreign wars for no benefit, and only to the benefit of the elites and at the expense of the average American, because it just gets, you know, hoiked on the national debt. Meanwhile, you know, Nancy Pelosi's share portfolio goes up. And then all the people who leave the federal government to work for these companies and vice versa end up being beneficiaries of those adventures. And the third thing I would say is that compared to like the, who was that guy who was touted to be like a leader of the Republicans, like in the Obama era? Paul Ryan, his name? You know, you get like those guys who, and even like Mitt Romney, who was so milquetoast on like the migration issue and on like demographics. I think MAGA is very much more attentive of that. And I think on those three pillars alone, you can see there's been a massive break in the old like Republican mentality and what is MAGA. And on those three bases, I think it's hard to judge MAGA negatively.
So next question then is from Int Boom, next super thanks. He says, excellent prediction, please accept my humble offering of great British pounds. By the way, what was that ominous discussion of values that Carl of Swindon mentioned to you during the Lotus Eaters election live stream? That seemed kind of weird of him. Well, that was the video I made defending value-free analysis. Now, I think what Carl was trying to hint towards, but obviously election night was not the right night to have that discussion. What he meant by that comment was he favors moral, like a moral laden analysis, or he thinks that we should use moral language. He's talked about this to me and others several times, whereas I am committed to the value free. And I made that video yesterday that you can watch. It was 50 minutes long, where I laid out my defense for value free analysis. This is an issue on which I am an outlier on in the space. Like I said, I mean, it's not just Carl, it's Panama Hat, it's probably Pharaoh, it's, you know, all of the Christians, you know, they want their, they tend not to want to go in for this. Dave, the distributist. And I mean, you can listen to my defense of value-free analysis and why I still think it is important. You know, like I was saying, you can break down why somebody scored a goal in football, and whether you're a Christian or not doesn't actually fucking matter. What matters is you're looking at the evidence on the ground and what the goals are in that situation. My moral feelings don't come into it. I can have a look at what is happening objectively on the ground, let's say in Gaza. Okay. Now, I may not like the idea of women and children being killed on a human level, but I also have to say, well, who is objectively closer to winning that conflict, or who? And when I've given various assessments before, I've said, well, you know, the fact is that Israel have basically gotten away with everything. Like, they have done everything they wanted to do, right? And there's been not that many real consequences for them so far. Okay, now they haven't actually won that war, but what I'm saying is that it's a value-free assessment. I don't have an agenda one way or the other, despite, you know, as on a human level, not liking the fact that innocent people are being killed, right? I mean, you have to put that aside for when you make the assessment. And not everybody does that. You know, like Judge Knapp, for example, he can't do that. He cannot put away his moral revulsion at what is happening in that situation. So he doesn't give a value-free analysis. He gives a partisan analysis. He is a partisan for the Palestinians in that crisis. But I think that partisan analysis, you know, loses its credibility. It loses its ability to actually see what's happening. And I think, I mean, if I was to make a value-free assessment of some of the stuff that Judge Knapp has put out over the past year, he does occasionally veer into all of the traps that I talked about. Cope, sunk cost, you know, wrong predictions and so on, because he's speaking with moral vehemence and emotion sometimes. Now, I still watch Judge Knapp, but I also take some of the stuff those guys say with a pinch of salt, because they have a side. They're partisans. I'd say the same thing about some other people. Like I watch the Duran, but let's be fair. The Duran have got a side in that conflict. They're not neutral, and you have to see that. And there are things on the other side of the ledger that people don't see. So I try as much as possible to do the value three thing. Now, it just so happens that my value three analysis is also that Russia's probably won that war as well. All right. But let's not pretend that all of the people who've been on that side of the conflict haven't also fallen into some of these problems. So anyway, I don't know if you guys have anything to say. Pharaoh, I expect you to be against value free analysis personally.
Well, hold on a second. I'm not necessarily against it, because again, if you're making decisions, I think it's a really interesting, again, lens to look through and to analyze your enemies. And again, if we objectively look at the AA's hit rate for predictions, I would say that it is markedly higher than your average political commentator. However, you know, you have missed a few things. And for example, you know, the Rishi pick for the Conservatives, and I think there's a few other small ones, and I think you've underestimated the illogicalness of humanity. And I think the one problem with Value Free is that it looks at the world through almost kind of like a quasi-utilitarian viewpoint, or again, like maybe like a Mises-esque way of the world. And look, what you underestimated was, for example, with the Conservatives, is that, you know, they were the most pro-gay, most pro-liberal party that was ever created, and didn't care about winning, and wanted to run with a candidate that was crap. So, do you know what I'm saying? And I think that's the one problem you have is like,
well, I mean, there is
it's too smart. It's too smart for its own good. Sometimes
there is a caveat, right? Often, where it's kind of, I mean, not always stated, but it's kind of bracketed. If they were smart, they'd do this, right? If they wanted to maximize their outcome, they would do this, okay? Now, with the Tories, they're just fucking idiots, okay? I mean, or even worse, or what is more likely in my view, they just wanted to lose, right? I mean, you know, the whole Kamala Harris is a jobber thing. The Tory party do this occasionally. They're just like, oh, it's not our time to be in office now. We're kind of just... there's some trouble coming up. And people talked about that. Like, why did Sunak call the election early? Do you remember there was that theory going around that he just, like, something was coming up and he didn't want it?
Yeah.
And, I mean, if you have a look at how the first few months of Starmer's gone, Sunak is actually looking like he's quite a smart guy now. He's kind of dodged all the bullets, and he's actually, like, retroactively become more popular, right? Because there's already Sunak nostalgia.
Fair this right, is so it. Anyway. I want the little dark age Sunak barbecuing wave to come back to the Tory party. I think the value theory, if you had like a council of advisors, I would definitely have a value free advisor on the board. But you know, I think it's one of the lenses that you want to look through.
You want Judge Knapp there as well, though.
Yeah, 100%. And again, exactly. I think there's something fun about like. Just obviously biased, like anti-enemy takes, because what that gives you is that there's something energetic about it as well. And I think that's the other problem with value free, because you're kind of like methodically looking through and then carefully analyzing. Sometimes it's good just to have the fire and the passion and the drive, and you know, that's what someone like Knapp can give. He can rile you up. He can, you know, that's what gets an army or a group of people going. So I think sometimes you need that kind of almost mythology and myth making as part of, you know, even if everyone knows that that's not necessarily the analytical truth, it's the spiritual truth is what I would say.
I mean, it is the distinction between doing politics and analysis that was upset.
Yes,
and in fairness to Dr. Steve, right, who I'm the number one fan of, as everybody knows, I made fun. Do you remember how much I made fun of the 18 videos he made about Bud Light?
Exactly.
Right. But yeah. Bud Light is like literally the only boycott that's ever worked ever. Right. So, I mean, you know.
Also, I imagine he's got a pool at home called Bud Light that he swims in, you know, from the revenue.
Now, Axeman, I made a 50-minute video talking about what value-free analysis is. You in the chat saying value-free is meaningless word salad. Banned. Outright banned for that comment. I do not spend 50 minutes laying out exactly what something is and explaining it in tedious detail only for you to say it's meaningless word salad. You're meaningless and your word salad, Axeman. Banned. Right. Anyway, let's carry on. All right. Where were we? How was that for passion?
That's great.
That was me being a partisan for my own.
Full partisan there by AA.
All right. Now, Bambos Giorgio says, is MMI behind the plan? Oh, so this is a comment on my debunking modern monetary theory video, which is one of those videos that never goes away. It's one of my biggest videos of all time. It's got 130,000 views. And I released it in 2020. And it still gets like daily views. It's one of those ones that never goes away. And I never really quite understand why.
I bet you're in the search listings for that. I'm going to type.
Yeah. I mean, I did one recently called on like why progressives fear traditionalism. And of all the videos I've made recently, that's the one that took off. Why? Who knows? Who knows? It's just random sometimes, you know, because I mean, it was just like some bog standard talking points for me, but that's the one that lit up. So, you know, but anyway, this person says, is modern monetary theory behind the plans to introduce digital currency? Also, is an intrinsic element of Tony Blair's digital ID to link your ID to your money so that every aspect of your life can be shut down at a flick of a switch? Some people seem to see digital ID as just an ID card with a barcode. Surely it's more than that. By the way, YouTube deleted one of my super thanks on the Hammer podcast. I think it may have been because I sent it straight after my first super thanks, so I'll repeat it here. Marcus Hearn edited a short-lived Hammer magazine while he was at Marvel UK. It's probably available on eBay. Also, an interesting crossover between Hammer and Carry On is the Ugly Duckling made by Hammer in 1959 starring Bernard Breslau. Well, yeah, there's another interesting, you know, Bernard Breslau, the big one from the Carry On films. He was contacted to play Frankenstein's monster in the original Curse of Frankenstein. And they asked his agent how much he wanted. And they said, Bernard will only work. He will not work for less than $10 a day. £10 a day. And they called up Christopher Lee's agent. And Christopher Lee's agent said, Christopher Lee will not work for less than £8 a day. And they gave Christopher Lee that job and launched him to international stardom. And Bernard Breslau went on to be Bernard Breslau. So just one of the kind of weird twists of fate. I mean, can you imagine they cast Bernard Breslau and the Curse of Frankenstein is actually shit or something? You know, I don't know. But, as to the other part of the super thanks about ID cards, I do think it's more sinister than simply just an IT card with a barcode. They can link it. They can get all sorts of data on you. And in fact, I have a video coming out tomorrow where I talk with a guy called Jason. How do you say his name again? Jason Marochik. Jason. Where we're talking about the elites behind Trump. One of the things we get into is how Elon Musk and Peter Thiel kind of up for the digital ID, same as Blair is, and same as their mutual friend Larry Ellison, who is the owner of Oracle. Yeah, we talk about the further ramifications of what that actually means, where, you know, it's not just that they're going to bring in the digital ID. One of these companies will own it. It could be Palantir, it could be Elon Musk, it could be Oracle. It'll be one of these private companies who will then, in the back end, have access to that data. This is one of those problems where they've suggested doing this for the NHS, for example, and it's been very controversial. People are like worried about private data being in the hands of, you know, people's public health records being in private hands, being in the hands of some company. This is coming down the pike, though. I can't really see any scenario where this doesn't happen, really, because I think Trump is going to be up for it, ultimately, because Elon Musk is there. And, well, as we talked about earlier on, Labour are just going to do whatever they want until either there's a revolution or we get another election. So I think it's happening, whether we like it or not. Red Plasterplane says, long-term for Europe, which might have been better. One, the Trump win for a stronger USA. Two, a Kamala win, US and West demise, perhaps giving Europe a chance to break free and take back their culture. The US, run by a certain group, seems to be at odds with Europe's culture and traditional demographics. Are you happy Trump won? Would you rather he lost? No, I think that the thing is, a Kamala win would have empowered the fuckwits who run Europe, right? People like Starmer, the EU lot, they would have been buoyed by a Kamala win, okay? Trump is isolationist, and he is basically going to give Europe a kick up the arse to start, you know, funding their own armies. There's going to be a general American withdrawal from Europe. So in a way, under Trump, you could actually see a stronger Europe, right? Under Biden is when we saw Nord Stream getting fucked over and the Ukraine war and the severing of Russian energy from Germany and all of that, wrecking, you know, years worth of deal making and projects, you know, putting our energy in crisis, tripling our energy bills. All of that happened under Biden. So I actually think that in a way, if America withdraws and just becomes more insular, because let's face it, Americans are insular. They don't care about anyone else. They don't care about Europeans. They could hate Europeans for all I care. Most of them don't, but some of them do. It doesn't really matter. If they're looking inwards and not looking outwards, it may actually give everybody else a chance to do the same. Because let's face it, everybody needs to do that, you know? So
there's a couple of things as well. I think this whole kind of like, you know, do what you like, domestic policy, support Israel, foreign policy. I think that there's more of a chance of that being rolled out across other countries in Europe. So, for example, you know, I wonder if Germany, something might happen in that regard, maybe even France. And like you said, the fundamental problem isn't necessarily with the EU's connection and collaboration. It's, again, what's the vision for EU? And I think if they have enough of those Trump configuration politicians, I think the Europe could be stronger. And again, maybe Spencer's solar empire will be forged. They'll anoint him as the sun emperor. I think it's hard to tell. But I think there is a chance of that happening. Well, I think, like you said, under Kamala, it's going to get. It would have been worse. And also, I like it when Americans disparage Europeans, because it forces them to defend their culture. So you know that tweet you were kind of highlighting the other day. You know, Europeans don't have washing machines. Europeans don't have washing machines. Europeans don't have high culture. Well, all of a sudden, if you're challenged out and called out like that, you then have to say, oh, actually, we do have all of these bits of high culture. We do place preference to this. Now, under the current regimes, they're trying to destroy all of that, in my opinion. They're trying to erase all forms of high culture. So I think a strong America, which calls out and disregards Europe, forces Europe to sort of stand up for itself and to say, actually, we are strong.
A point of order, Pharaoh. Right. A washing machine and a tumble dryer is not high culture, okay?
No, the tweet said Europeans don't have washing machines, but also they don't have high culture. And I mean, obviously, the washing machine thing is ridiculous. But
I mean, the French have got tumble dryers and washing machines, but they've also got the Champs-Élysées, right? They've also got the Palace of Versailles. In Italy, they've got the fucking Colosseum there.
Yeah, but my point is,
under the
current regimes, all of those things are disregarded and spat upon. They don't want to talk about even the idea of high culture is despicable to the European elite right now. But if you have an isolationist America, which constantly disregards and, you know, like says how rubbish Europe is, the natural response, you know, this is a classic. This is what you do in marketing. If you want to get a response out of someone, you slag them off or act angrily to them. And then all of a sudden, you'll get the least base person out there saying how wonderful the culture of France and Europe is. You know, you'll get a communist saying how wonderful, high art is, when only 2 weeks beforehand they were trying to sell it off or to disregard it. So that's my opinion. I want an isolationist America, constantly slagging off European culture, forcing Europe to step up and stand up for themselves and to be positive and strong in the history and traditions they have.
Marcus, any thoughts on this? I'll just mention, by the way, that Maloney's looking kind of more fashy these days. She's kind of, is she like deliberately?
Maybe Maloney's out to disprove Mr. D's thesis after all. Who's to say?
Anyway, yeah.
Sorry, just quickly on that. Did you hear that is like what the culture minister had like an Evola quote about the solar empire or something like that? That was going around maybe last.
Yeah.
And also they're doing the first kind of big futurist exposition in Rome for like 70 years, and obviously the futurists were tied to a certain group of
movement.
People. As well.
Movement.
So I wonder, like, certainly culturally, they're trying to bring back that entire era was forgotten about. But I think in most Italian, like for many Italians' hearts, it was kind of like viewed rather positively, certainly culturally. And I think that I wonder if she's trying to rehabilitate that to a degree. But anyway, that's just maybe
entirely possible. Given the origins of the party, Fratelli d'Italia, that's entirely possible. But just on the point about the anti-European animosity displayed by certainly not all Americans, but a subset of Americans, sadly, is that what I find kind of amusing about this whole thing is a few people mentioned Cernovich in the chat, is that if you actually look at Cernovich's name, like Cernovich is he's a descendant of continental Europeans himself. So it's kind of like a self-loathing criticism in a way. That's not an interesting observation.
I tell you what I always find weird about it is that it just comes with such bile and hatred. It's like, where is this coming from? Because I don't think it's reciprocal.
It's visceral, isn't it?
I don't think that you ever, like, okay, there's maybe a little bit of disdain, but, you know, you've got to understand the French are like that about everybody, right? Or there's a little bit of, there could be a bit of, you know, British, just a bit, the British are like that about everybody, right?
Yeah, right. I was going to say, at worst, of, like, anyone familiar with, like, Clarkson Top Gear, right? Because he actually used to do his own series of documentaries aside from Top Gear. He, I think he was in, like, a Las Vegas parking lot, and he saw, like, these gaudy, you know, like, gold-plated Lamborghinis and stuff. And he basically said, like, America's a nation of, like, very wealthy gorillas or something, or, like, something to that effect. Mm-hmm. I can't remember, or chimpanzees, whatever it was. It's like, that's the most egregious thing a European or even, like, a Briton would say about America as, like, a comical kind of observation, whereas when it's done in the opposite direction, when it's the new world criticizing old Europe, it's very acidic and very visceral, like, you know, you can tell it comes from a very dark place, and the way Cernovich said
weirdly hateful,
yeah.
Because they always do this thing.
America stems from Europe, you know, in a sense.
They always do this thing. It's like, yeah, well, at least we're not like kind of like being wrecked by, like, you know, at least we're not living under Sharia law or something. And you see, you also get this really, really weird thing where their entire view of what Europe is formed by slop, essentially, like right-wing slop. Now, obviously, there are some problems in Europe, okay? But if you actually look at the raw facts, like Sweden always gets it, for example. But the raw data of even Sweden is nowhere near as bad as any. I mean, yeah, Sweden's got its problems, but demographically, most of Europe is nowhere near where America is.
And I mean, that being said, would you rather live in Uppsala or Baltimore? I mean,
again, this is what I want. I want nations arguing with other nations, because it's anti-globalizing at the same time. It's anti-egalitarian, because if one nation says your culture sucks and my culture's better, that's creating cultural divisions. So it's kind of it's anti-egalitarian. That's what I like about it. I want nations fighting nations culturally. You know,
friendly
competition
between peer nations, right?
Not even friendly. I want a struggle for cultural majesty,
wants another 100 years war between France and England. Right?
culturally, in art, is what I'm saying.
One of the clips I put in that Clarkson video, by the way, was when Clarkson went to Washington, and he had the placard of British inventions and got himself arrested. Do you remember that? Was kind of made me laugh that he actually got himself arrested there. But it was probably a stunt for TV, but you know what I mean.
I was going to say, if you watch like a lot of Clarkson's material, I mean, even separate from Top Gear, and you actually read his books, if there is a boomer who is going to heel turn himself, it will be Clarkson. There is a based straining him somewhere, but it's just like, will that be outweighed by his shitlibbery and his peers who probably have those sentiments? Like, people in the chat mentioned he's like mates with, you know, David Cameron and, you know, a few other people. And yeah, just, I guess it depends which part of Clarkson is ascendant at this point in time.
Ralph Gilsenbaker says, the format of re-uploading works so well. It really feels like Radio 4 for woke people. I'm really enjoying it. Well, that was not actually that was actually done after I got a copyright notice for literally 8 seconds of Hendrix in the intro that the guy who made the intro made for the long American intro, which I don't use very often because most of the American videos
Which song was it, AO?
It's the National Anthem, isn't it? Hendrix playing the Star Spangled Banner.
His rendition of Star Spangled Banner, yeah.
Right. Yeah. It's literally 8 seconds of it, and they worldwide blocked the stream. Now, that's available now because I disputed it, and after 2 days, if they don't respond, it comes back online. But how petty is that? I mean, I've never seen that before, like for such a small little snippet. And you can barely hear it because there's other sounds going on as well. So yeah, I was pretty surprised. And I've used that before, and it didn't. I honestly think that it's because Carl was on the stream. Somebody's got it in for Carl.
Shut it down.
Dorcas Maximus says, thanks. That was on Why Progressives Fear the Rise of Traditionalism, the video that just won't die. It's over 100,000 now as well. Quite why, I don't know. It's always the ones I knock off that do well, and the ones I effort post never do well. Do you ever find that? I don't know.
Yes, 100%.
The
stuff that I love, no one likes, and it's always stuff that I thought, oh, that was just crap, it was rubbish, and then everyone's like, oh, that's the best thing, and it's really annoying.
I mean, that video, I literally cut an off-the-cuff promo and stuck images of a nice English village from the 1930s over it and gave it that title. And for some reason, that one took off. I'll never understand the alchemy of what takes off and what doesn't take off. You just have to kind of go with the algo gods, I guess.
It's kind of voodoo, isn't it, in a way?
Yeah, I mean, it's just there's no rhyme or reason to it, really. Esoteric Alderman says, I recently had to teach a class on decolonization. So this was on the critical thinking video from yesterday. In the context of social psychology to first year undergrads, I decided to try and be a bit naughty here and to attempt to deconstruct the colonization lens itself, to expose the discipline not just as Western, but as extremely liberal, individualistic, and often with leading thinkers coming from a very specific group in New York in the 20th century. I didn't name any names here, obviously, although I do tell them to watch Adam Curtis. What advice would you give to teachers or lecturers behind enemy lines when grappling with these topics who want to enable at least one or two canny students to maybe come away with basic conclusions as opposed to leftist ones? Well, I used to use exactly that technique as well. I would try to encourage them to deconstruct things that had already been deconstructed and gone through wokeism, right? I mean, I used to give them Vogue magazine with like a powerful black woman on the front and ask them to deconstruct what power is trying to tell them. Because the thing is with these various lenses is that they're designed to endlessly deconstruct 1950s America. They struggle then when you turn the lens on stuff from now, when the left is quite clearly in power. And so I used to have a lot of fun doing that, push them out of their comfort zone, because students are feckless and lazy and unoriginal and churn out basically stuff that they think their teachers want to see. So you can always push them a bit, and they'll enjoy your lessons way more than the lesson from the woke lesbian next door, who is only there due to regime loyalty. So make the most of it while you're there, I would say. Anyway, what else have we got? Coney says on Entropy, I'm concerned that getting behind a British Farmers Party, Clarkson-led or not, is not buying into is buying into the myth of bottom up politics. Thoughts wrong. And I, well, why is it automatically wrong? Answers on a postcard. The farmers are a distinct class. They do something vital. They are an automatic power block. So if they get politically organized, they are automatically an organized minority, which is identifiable by everybody because everybody knows what a farmer does. So it's not bottom-up politics. It is literally organized factional politics is what it is.
So. Also, the profile of the average farmer is someone, again, yes, a lot of their wealth is tied to the lands, but they will be higher earners as well. So I would say if you were to look at them from a status-wise, you'd say they're upper middle class or maybe like some of the larger landowners, elite status as well. So, you know, they have money behind them as well, which I think is important for that organization and doing stuff.
Coney also says there's a channel called Farming Explained, run by a young British farmer. He has these really annoying shit-lib tendencies. He explains the history of modern agriculture quite well. You should probably check out some of his videos. Okay. Brugleham says, I'd love for Trump to go to the UK, have a live stream dinner with Clarkson, and bring up Clarkson running for PM. Give him an open support. Yeah, now I'm not sure what Clarkson thinks of Trump, because I was reading some of his various different columns to see kind of the things he's been saying. And he did characterize the US election as a contest between a mad man and a mad woman.
This is boomer brain, can I just say, where again they're afraid of losing social cred with their peers by backing him.
Also, I've seen a few comments in the chat here just sort of saying that maybe Clarkson isn't full tilt TDS, but he's sort of definitely cynical about Trump and isn't a fan of him at all. So bit of a pity, because they sort of manifest sort of similar tendencies in some ways. But yeah, Clarkson clearly isn't on the same page from the looks of it.
Yeah, I mean, I see, the thing is that I'm just all right with him leading this farmers thing. Just leave him, like, that alone could be transformational. We don't need him to become the prime
Absolutely.
Minister.
Exactly. You know?
Just in terms of Trump coming back, you and Carl mentioned about Trump demanding the red carpet being rolled out. I think that'd be way more effective than him meeting any other political figure, just having this kind of glorious, triumphant, emperor-esque arrival in the UK, the pomp and circumstance around it, and the kind of the vital energy that would come out of that would be way more powerful and make people and shock people into what could be more than any kind of chat with Nigel Farage or, you know, some kind of cringy. Just imagine Constantine Kisten. He would love to have an interview with Trump or something like that. You know, there's a possibility that might happen.
But picture it though, right? Like the US, like Air Force One lands like at Heathrow, right? And the US motorcade just drives straight out of London in the direction of Oxfordshire towards the Cotswolds and pulls into Diddley Squat Farm, and just Trump, like, just, you know, dragging his balls on the ground, like, just shake Clarkson's hand inside of Diddley Squat. The reverberations of that scene would just be monumental. Like, he ignores Parliament, ignores White House, ignores the Big Ben, like, just goes straight to Diddley Squat.
Redacted Brainwave says the difference between Clarkson and Trump is that Trump behaves like a boss. Clarkson has had moments of surrender. Trump is an aggressive fighter. Yeah, I mean, they have very different backgrounds, of course. I mean, let's not forget that Trump had years of being trained by Roy Cohn. And basically, I mean, Trump's early years is, I mean, it's like coming up as a gang boss or something. Like, I mean, you can't, it's almost impossible to put yourself in that kind of milieu that he came out of, right? It like rough, ruthless, you know, New York scene that he came out of. Basically gangsters. I mean, not like the actual mob, but it all operated like that. There was actually a film.
Mind you, he cut his teeth at the time the mob was still active in New York, though, to be fair.
Yeah, well, there was a film made called The Apprentice. I've only seen clips of this. I've seen like a few like key clips of it showing like this Roy Cohn character essentially training Trump to be ruthless in this way. And in fact, I think the narrative arc goes that, you know, once he trained him up, Trump did the Darth Plagueis. He did the Sidious on Cohn, right? Later, like, I think he fucked Cohn over once he'd, like, learned all his powers type thing, which, of course, you have to do to become the master and not the apprentice, right? I mean, which is what the whole film is about. Exactly. But it's kind of a... Clarkson just does not come from... Clarkson comes from Middle England, right? He does not... He doesn't come from that dog-eat-dog world.
He's Trump a Dorchester boy, isn't he? Yeah, he's from Yorkshire, yeah.
The current mood says, we should send a loud and clear message to encourage Clarkson. Tweets, emails, or letters. The more people who voice support, the greater his resolve. Yeah, is Clarkson still on Twitter? I don't think he is he? I think he left Twitter.
Yeah, he's on Twitter. No, he's here.
Does he still tweet? Jeremy Clarkson. Let's have a look. Oh, yeah, he does. He sent a tweet on the 3rd of November. But it doesn't look like one. Oh, yeah, it is him, because one of his tweets is, Rachel Reeves, I literally daren't comment. So, I mean, he obviously hates this government. So, another one of Clarkson's recent tweets, fucking cunting, wanking, fucking shitting rain. So, I mean, that's not a social media team. That is Clarkson himself, right?
That's farmer talk, by the way. Just
Joseph Steelin says, Johnson is already jumping up on the farmer thing. See GB News interview. T1000 could reassemble around this issue. Yeah, and this is it. This is like when you have Farage not throwing away his chances, right? Farage is basically the opposite of Filippo Inzaghi, furious. He is like fucking Emil Heskey.
The anti-poacher just can't fucking score.
Just like, you know, just fucking useless. Yeah, I mean, at this rate, T1000 is going to reassemble. You know,
Go on.
Because of Kemi.
Yeah. Also, Boris is irrelevant now. Like, what's he going to do? He's not in the cabinet. All he can do is comment from the side. He's got no credibility with anyone at all. He's used up. He should. He had his chance to get back into the game again, and I think that moment's gone. I genuinely think he's used up. All he's going to do, he's going to sort of circle around the traditional media set, slowly kind of like fading into obscurity. Kemi and the team, again, it's interesting. Like, maybe some of the local MPs have voice their support, but is anyone else making hay over this? Sorry, excuse the pun. Like, has Kemi said anything, or any of their team?
Let's have a look. Let me have a little look. If Kemi has been active on Twitter, isn't it amazing that we look on Twitter now? We don't look at the news. Has Kemi Badenoch tweeted about the farmers? Lest we forget, Remembrance Sunday. No, she hasn't touched it.
Yeah, you see.
Oh, she has. Okay, she didn't retweet Clarkson. She retweeted Steve Barkley, commenting on what Rachel Reeves on a Telegraph article about Rachel Reeves dealing a blow to farmers. So, I mean, this is again Kemi, objectively shit. So it's like we've got, you know, Emil Heskey up against bloody Jose Altidore or something. It's just Franny Jeffers, you know, some like really shit striker who can't hit like a barn door.
If you were sensible, it doesn't matter about policies. This is like traditional conservative winning ground. They're associated with the countryside. They're meant to represent the countryside. They should be hitting this so hard. They should be commenting on the video. They should be challenging people in Prime Minister's Question Time. But the fact she hasn't even retweeted out that ex-Labour advisor's video yet shows to me that it's not a priority internally. Again, it's just no one's doing anything about this. And this is part of why I feel like Labour's going nowhere, and they know it, because they're crap, but they know that there is just literally no threat from anyone else out in the marketplace now.
Atlas Code says, if a young Prince George was really based and thought like you, how might he go about reestablishing sovereignty and save the country? Well, I mean, the first thing he'd have to do is not believe the nonsense that if the royal family ever did anything, right, ever made a political call, the people would be out in the streets and the people would support the royal family over the fuckwits in Parliament. I mean, let's pretend if it was a standoff between this Labour Party and the royal family. You really think the people are going to come out for Keir Starmer's Labour Party? There'll be a couple of dipshit socialists in the street, but there'd be even more patriots, way more patriots out in the street for the royal family.
People would flock to Charles in a heartbeat compared to Starmer.
I've always thought that if you were to kind of gamify the situation, that the royal family always get a buff with the military, you know, and I think that they would. That's the route I would go down if I was George, because, you know, they've got much stronger ties. They know people. They send all their kids there. They're well known in those circles. So that's how I would go about doing it. Classic military coup.
Atlas, when I would now, for the purposes of Mohan, we are talking in the hypothetical, sir. Neil Mohan, did you have breakfast this morning? The Devastator says, furious, it would be a good time to mention the misinformation bill to AA, and the reason that the ACMA is desperately trying to push this through Parliament. He might want to mention the fact it's a complete blanket DID enforcement bill to wipe out dissent. Is that in Australia, misinformation bill? Furious.
Yeah, I've just popped something in the private chat here on StreamYard. If you just want to have a look at it, maybe we can do like a very brief read through, because it has it explained as to what it is. If you want to try and elucidate the degree of condescension in this document, it's almost sickening. And also I do have something up here from infrastructure.gov.au. Do you want to read, or shall I read? Just very briefly.
Yeah, have a little read of it. Yeah, go on.
Yeah, so the ACMA is the Australian Communications and Media Authority, which is a regulatory body for, you know, these sort of issues. The website is titled Online Misinformation. Misinformation is false, misleading, or deceptive information that can cause harm. Highly subjective. Misinformation explained. Misinformation can include made-up news articles, doctored images and videos, false information shared on social media, scam advertisements. Misinformation can pose a risk to people's health and safety, as well as to society more generally. We have seen this with misinformation regarding COVID-19 vaccines and 5G technology. Some misinformation is deliberately spread. This is called disinformation, to cause confusion, undermine trust in governments or institutions. It is also used to attract users to web pages for financial gain, where they may click on ads or be lured to financial scams. But not all misinformation is deliberately spread to cause harm. Some users share misinformation without realizing it. And so basically what they're, for those who don't know, Australia passed a metadata bill back in the previous government, the Morrison government. So they've been harvesting metadata here for years. And this is basically a means by which they intend to empower the regulatory body with... in order to, on one hand, collect data from users or potential perpetrators of misinformation and disinformation, and then the second thing is to actually bring various companies sort of on board. Where, if you scroll down that webpage a little bit more, you'll see the Australian Code of Practice for Disinformation and Misinformation. Let's go further down, a bit further down past this. There we go, yeah. So if you scroll down there, was published in February 2021. Oh, no, keep going. Go back up. You've just gone past it. Go back here. Here we go. No, further up, further up, further up. There we go. Stop, stop, stop. Was published in February 2021 by the Digital Industry Group Incorporated. It currently has 9 signatories, including Adobe, Apple, Google, Meta, Microsoft, Redbubble, TikTok, Twitch, and Legitimate. So basically, this is sort of to permit governments and regulatory bodies having access to these companies and the information regarding users and perceived degrees of misinformation or disinformation. So if this bill passes, good luck, A, remaining anonymous in Australia, and B, good luck having any kind of dissension against government policy or against any kind of, I suppose,
any,
law of the land.
Any chance that Elon Musk fucks this up for them?
Fuck this up for the government, as in like the implementation?
I.e. the Trump government just says, yeah, this is fucking out of order, we're not having it. Because there was talk going around that there was a threat.
Britain or Europe, wasn't it? Yeah.
Well, made to the EU that, if you do this, if you keep on having a go and trying to legislate X, we'll just pull out of NATO.
Yeah, basically, yeah. And I suppose they could do similar things with Australia, in terms of either, our military obligations to each other, firstly, and then secondly, one thing Australia is unnerved about with Trump's new trade policy is the tariff proposition. And I suppose that Trump could always use that as a carrot and stick approach, because I mean, this is really going to throw Australian people under the bus in to a degree that we already are, sort of already have the foot on our necks. This will totally sell us out the toilet, really, sadly.
Brulaham says, I mean, you see, I'm in a kind of catch 22 on the will Trump and Elon quash this, because from another point of view, it's like, well, hold on, this is like domestic policy. So since when does America, I'm kind of like in a
catch 22 sort of, yeah. Just very briefly, if I may as well, if we shan't forget, during COVID, when we had emergency powers here, a lot of legislation was rammed through Parliament, which basically did empower the government to many aspects of like data harvesting anyway. Because for those who have either watched the streams we've done, like when you've had me on, we've talked about it, or if people have watched Lotus Eaters, because obviously this stream here is about agriculture, and a lot of measures were passed regarding like Australia's relationship towards native title, the Mabo Act, and the Cultural Heritage Act, which is, in terms of farmers basically couldn't dig like a 6-foot hole without, permission from their local elder or their local Aboriginal council, which basically tied farmers' hands for the better part of a year for fear of litigation. A lot of these measures were passed during COVID as well, when governments basically had free rein to pass this kind of legislation. And so Australia's sort of march towards this kind of tyranny is already well underway, regrettably so. And certainly the focus that specifically this government has placed on that has been quite unnerving, actually.
Yeah, one thing I will say is that I sent out a tweet a while back saying that I supported Australia's ban on under-16s using social media, and got swiftly upbraided by Lady of Shalott, naturally.
Because that's the thing,
as a parent, I don't think any parent wants their kids on social media at all. Mine is just turning 5 now, and I'm already kind of dreading the moment that inevitably all your friends have got a mobile phone. How are you gonna,
and she discovers that realm?
I just don't want her on social media, period. Yeah, and exactly. I know the argument is always the same libertarian argument, right? I mean, Dan from Lotus Eaters put this, they're just kind of, taking parenting out of the hands of people. But let's face it, right? Let's face it. I might be a responsible parent, and Farrah might be a responsible parent, but most people are fuckwits. Most people are fuckwits. And in this day and age, unless it comes from the government, it's just not going to happen. If you leave it up to people, everybody's going to be on social media. So,
yeah, and also there's that sort of more sort of classicist argument, is that the government should exist in order to enshrine our freedoms too, but also there's a degree that people should have freedoms from, and one of them is like the evils of what kind of things children are exposed to. It's why like our children aren't exposed to nudity. It's why our children are sheltered from certain things. And I almost think that you could almost categorize social media as one of those evils from which children should be sheltered. I emphatically agree. And the problem is in regards to this measure in Australia is that for all intents and purposes, I support this measure if our government cared about the people, which it does not. It is the inverse. Our government, like most of our governments, despise us, and I do not trust them to implement this policy with any degree of you know, just virtue or moral vigor. It will be used against us like everything else is.
Yeah, I mean, one way or the other, though, I do hope that we have seen the last generation of kids raised on social media. That the generation of AAA and yours, Pharaoh, will not grow up on social media. That we've learned that this is not something
it's interesting. I'm 100% in agreement with you. My child will not be receiving a phone. In terms of strategy, I've always said that I'm just going to tell my child I never had a smartphone growing up, and I'm asking for you to do the same thing that I did myself. And that's always been my plan. But my concern is it's not just social media, it is screens and devices in general. And I think just as pernicious is mobile phones and tablets used as soma to shut up children. So for example, I was at my child's school the other day, and about half their kids had brought half the parents had brought some kids along, and half of those were just watching something on their phone for the entire time. And I do wonder, again, this is in a more kind of like middle class, well-to-do area. I just wonder, like, nationally, how many children are being raised on screens as a substitute for actual parenting. So I think even if you got rid of the social media, I think the screens thing is as equally a pernicious thing, you know, Cocomelon as father, you know.
100%, Sarah, couldn't agree with you more.
Bit of breaking news, by the way. The Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, has resigned.
Just now. Ooh, Farage with the kill shot.
So, whether it was Farage that pushed him over the edge, you know. So, I still think Farage should be concentrating on Clarkson. But
totally, yeah.
Point is, Welby's just gone. I will say, is it significant? It won't be unless you get a based Archbishop of Canterbury, right?
They're going to be even worse. I can tell you.
It'll probably be a black lesbian or something.
I don't think it'll be a lesbian, but I think it will definitely be a black person. For sure. I'm 100% sure of that.
Well, why not make it Calvin Robinson?
He's not even a member of CFE. He's in like a weird friarship. I think you're right. It's interesting because I know it relatively well, but I think they'll do a anti-LGBT but ethnic person, you know, a BAME person, sorry.
I don't think they'll even be the base. I think they'll be a pro. I think
they will do. If you know what the lay of the land is like, I would say 3/4 of CFE churches are anti-LGBT. Even a lot of the bishops are, if I'm honest with you. So,
the church is going to go slightly more based in your view?
Based as in keep the position they've been in since Henry VIII.
In my mind, Justin Welby might as well be a full-on pride flag wearing kind of, you know.
I mean, that's true, but it's like it's not really about him. I think the bishops are more important. They have more power over the local diocese and stuff like that. So we'll see.
Okay, Justin Welby's made a huge shift on homosexuality.
Yeah, this is what I'm saying. There's big revolts happening right now. A lot of big churches not paying their parish share and stuff like that. So I think it's not just this this issue that's forcing him out. People are very unhappy with. He's basically trying to push through gay marriage through the back door. Excuse the pun. And a lot of people aren't happy.
What a surprise that somebody who oversaw No. Sex pestery.
No.
So, I mean, it's just kind of interesting how often that happens anyway. Bruderham says, AA, show some videos of the borders are. 60-minute one is classic. Is best appointment yet. Some of the others are slop neocons, garbage. I'm afraid, Bruderham, we do not have time because our, unlike my solo streams, these two chaps have rabbited on for fun. We're running late. Marcos 588 says, the tragic thing is that they have Clarkson convinced there is consumption of meat is what causes recent heart issues. They're trying. Oh, yeah. I mean, Clarkson's gone on a plant-based diet now because he's he is not looking very well, though, to be fair. He's not in the best health. Yeah.
And that's the thing, too. Like, if you listen to anyone like Rod Ignatius or myself or anyone else, Fio, you'll know that his obesity and his issues are not to do with meat, but almost everything else associated with the lifestyle. But anyway, that's the power the doctors have, sadly. And boomers buy it hook, line, and sinker.
Okay, I'll carry on. Do we actually know someone who's had to go like vegetarian on doctor's advice? I'm not going to name that person, but one of our buddies. Redacted Brainwave says, I think Musk hides his true power level. I think that's true. Jacob Lowe says, Ben Shapiro will always break allegiances at the drop of a little hat. Maverick Jones says, Maverick Jones says, if you were to get ready for another bat, if I were you, I'd get ready for another Banhammer phase on the scale of 2018. Watch Black Pills, Devin Stack, newest episode on Trump. I'm not bothered about that. That's not going to happen. And if it does, well, so long, everybody. Redacted says, hey, love your work. Found it very hard to believe that attempting to take a step back and have objective analysis was so controversial. Well, that's what happens when you surround yourself with crazy Christians, I suppose. Bruderham says, Carl's value-laden analysis leads him to know that Russia would be crushed easily by American troops deployed to the east. Carl's analysis on that bit was, I mean, furious. Did you hear that? That was bad. Did you hear Carl's analysis of the prospect of a war between America and Russia?
I did catch that, actually.
What
was the nub of it?
America basically will win a land war.
He basically said America would crush Russia in a land war. Which just
interesting.
Kind of... I mean, I don't know what else to say.
No.
Bruderham
says...
Carl,
I have to say I beg to differ, but anyway, I'll leave it there.
Bruderham says, land wars are easy and the deep experience of Americans in these compared to the lack of experience of the Russian army in the East, makes it easy to analyze and know. Charles Mackey says, good morning from America. Good morning, Charlie. I won't do a Robin Williams impression. Coney, do you remember? Good morning, Vietnam. I'm not going to go into my rant about how much I hate Robin Williams and what he represents. That there's a kind of like mushy sentimentalism that he represents that was at the heart of American culture for a while there, and indeed
isn't,
our culture.
Isn't he one of the kind of key core pins of Fresh Prince, though? I wonder. It's that kind of.
Well, I mean, I never got around to it, but I wanted to do a whole stream just laying into Robin Williams and know all he stands for, because like he's kind of like a beloved figure. I feel like he's beloved for like all the wrong reasons. He's like the ultimate boomer icon, Robbie Williams.
Yeah, that's
not Robbie Williams, who's actually kind of based these days, but Robin Williams. Coney says Trump's pick for Marco Rubio of Secretary of State was very disappointing. A win for gay little manlets like Fuentes everywhere. I'm sure Fuentes was not happy with Rubio as a pick. Bruderham says, Cernovich isn't European, he's an American. Fuck yeah. He's evolved beyond through the process of negrification, as Evelyn described. Actually, a lot of people told me that Cernovich may have certain background. Surprise, surprise. Retron, I didn't know that about him, but apparently he does. Retrona says, just saying hello to all of you here tonight. Thank you very much. Pete the Drummer says, Farage is containment to keep the likes of Nick Griffin out. John Lister says, hooray for office hours. Broman Hank says, I'm calling it. Kemi, the next PM, T-1000 always returns. I think the basic idea, by the way, is to cycle Kemi out before the election, that they wouldn't actually go into an election. Yeah. She is basically... She's IDS. She's IDS to hold the place while the party sorts itself out.
You know who would be good? Again, if I was Team Evil here, I think Kearns. I think Kearns could have something. I genuinely think so. She's the Pie Queen. She's kind of, because she can do all of that kind of like rural chat. She can do that. She can protect. She has the just amount of faux conservatism to her, but actually in her beating heart is the rainbow flag, which is exactly what they're looking for in a candidate. So I don't know. I wonder if she will get more exposure as time goes on. I just like it from a story perspective, you know, just AA's dark rival and nemesis. Well,
Do you know what the Pie Queen did? I had to take that video down, right? Because the screenshot I used was of Kearns at an LGBT march, right? Yes. And the original photographer copyright struck that video. And I had like the actual image that I used in the thumbnail. And I'd never seen that before. Straight copyright strike.
It's a PR team. It's our PR team.
Yeah. And I got directly in touch and they were pretty apologetic and they were like, oh, you know, I have free speech and stuff. But, you know, this was like a, you know, you didn't have permission to use this picture. But that was basically a hit to get that video off the internet.
It's interesting.
Isn't that incredible that Alicia Kearns has that sort of power? So, because, I mean, that was a direct hit by me on Pie Queen. Anyway.
This is what I'm saying. There's a grand narrative happening between you two. You're eventually going to meet up and fight to the death, I think.
Okay. Or something else could happen.
maybe.
Okay, somebody sent me this link to somebody sent me a link on X to this clip of the dude.
Is this the Brilheim one? Yeah.
Yeah, apparently it's only a couple of seconds long from this Borders R. Okay, let's just play a little bit of this from Autism Capital.
And I picked up people that were known illegal immigrants, entered the country illegally. And I put them in the truck and I fed them. And I said to them, where would you like to go? And they said, this state, that state. And I would drive them to whatever location they were asking for. Would I not be guilty of human trafficking? Would I not be guilty of aiding and abetting and lawbreaking? In all likelihood, if Harris and Biden, if their DOJ found out I did that, well, what are the odds they would have arrested me and put me in jail for as long as they possibly could, probably the rest of my life?
You'd be arrested and charged with a felony. You'd be in violation of Title 8 in the United States.
Apparently, this is not the clip. This is the clip. Hold on.
Is there a way to carry out mass deportation without separating families?
Of course there is. Families can be deported together.
Amazing.
There is actually a truth to that. And I think essentially if you're doing an aggressive remigration plan, that has to happen. But I do wonder whether there's going to be issue with the lunar persuasion, you know, because I think their empathy is exceptionally high. And I think if you should test this out, AA, you should ask Mrs. AA what she thought about deporting children, and I wonder whether there'll be a big backlash from women against that.
Frankly, who fucking cares? Trump won.
But I'm saying you have to step over them, is what I'm saying. But I think it's going to be one of the challenges.
Yeah, just let them cry. Fuck them. $11 cheese says, thoughts on Trump's appointment of four arch philo-Semites over the past 48 hours. Can we all expect to receive en masse Claudine Gay treatment? Well, I mean, I said it was baked into the pie. I mean, I said this was the reason he won. So I'm not surprised whatsoever. But it really depends, because they could still do a pile of base stuff, plus, like, allow Israel to do what they want, you know? Do I think that this means that Trump is going to go to war with Iran? No, I don't. Ionic Echo says, could the Iranian assassination story be an instance of priming from the media? I think it's an extremely clumsy bit of priming, like a really shit one. No. But yes, it is.
The thing is, if you're doing that, you need to layer things up. That's kind of like the end point. Do you know what I'm saying? That's the revelation moment. A good prime, you do stuff like, oh, we uncovered this plot to take out Donald Trump. We found, here's this crazy figure, this Iranian leader of this weird division wants to kill Donald Trump. Here's a quote from him. And then all of a sudden, then you have the kind of climax, which is we've got this expose document about how Iran wanted to assassinated Donald Trump. That's how you do. Do you know what I'm saying? It's an arc. It's like a story. It's like any good story. You need a beginning, middle, and end with a climax. And they started off with all. They started with a finish with no build up whatsoever.
Absolutely. Joe B. Hume says, your value-free analysis is missing the research of Alison McDowell Webb 4.0, RFK Elon Trump, Fourth Industrial Revolution Digital Plantation. Okay, I will check that out. It sounds a little bit School of Schizo, if I have to be honest, but I'm not going to judge a book by its cover. But the fact that you wrote that in all caps doesn't fill me with hope. I'll be honest. But I will have a look in the interests of value freeness. Okay, I can see here already. Okay, I've got it geared up to watch. When I have my lunch, I'll watch this Alison McDowell thing. Constant Manifold says, now that we are the woke right, will you rename Boomer Truth Regime to Critical Boomer Theory? No, I don't accept the label of woke right. I reject the dialectic, and I don't think that it's a foregone conclusion that cringe Lord Kissin, cringe Lord Francis Foster, cringe Lord James Lindsay, and various other cringe lords are going to win this battle. They're not going to win this battle. We will fuck you up. We will fuck you up. It will be the other way around. Okay, Tucker Carlson, all of the people I mentioned just now, they're not having it. The base isn't having it. Nobody's having your woke right bullshit. So it is not going to go the way they think it's going to go.
That's it. Just on that, in the kind of linguistic battlefield, just never don't engage with it. What they want you to do is they want you to seethe and to try and do these long video documentaries about, like, trying to analyze and explain how you're not woke right or whatever. Just don't engage with it at all. You either got to step over it or literally just spit in their faces whenever they mention it. That's the only way to deal with it.
We will fuck you up.
Yeah, exactly. The way this works
is their authority will drain, and their credibility will drain, their influence will drain, and the people who stay true will not. That is how the MAGA movement works. You haven't learnt this in 8 years, you dipshits. So that's what's going to happen.
But yeah. Also, I mean, I wasn't commenting on you, but various people have, you know, tried to theory sell it and try and be like, oh, actually, this is what it means, or actually, this is just don't engage with it whatsoever. Never let the enemy define the frame, you know. So,
anyway. Absolutely. And they'll keep on trying, or they may give up because it's failed dismally. Brulaham says, just play the 16-second clip below. I did that. Devastator, final super chat, says, does Chris Gard now have a chance with Anna Kasparian due to her conversion? but he has been thirsting after Anna for a very long time. Do we give Gard a chance now that Anna is queen of the based?
50-50 coin flip.
Well, there we go.
But go out of Gard.
All right. Where can people find you, Pharaoh?
I'm on Twitter. I have a YouTube channel where I talk about art stuff. Also, if you haven't done it yet, it's Christmas time's coming up. You need to buy yourself Foundations of Entrepreneurship. It's the premier e-learning guide to starting and running a business, written and voiced over by myself. It's over 20 hours of content for less than £200. What a bargain. So treat yourself this Christmas time. Buy Foundations of Entrepreneurship. Other foundations are available.
Marcus, where can people find you?
Well, as always, just on Twitter. If you fancy following for my shenanigans, you're welcome to do so. And speaking of Christmas, AM and I have a couple little surprises in the works for the next few weeks. So keep an eye out on Apostolic Majesty's channel and see what we put out.
All right, great. I will see you again tomorrow for Adam Curtis review for Deepest Lore. And also I have that long conversation with Jason about some of the elites behind Trump, not just Elon Musk and Peter Thiel and not just the Zionists, but there's another secret group that we talk about. All will be revealed when we do that video tomorrow. Most importantly of all, everyone, buy the courses, etc. Get out.
What goes on in this town is none of your business.
As long as I'm living here, it is.
Then maybe you shouldn't be living here!
Well, that's easily fixed.